This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome Kathy Allen. She is chairman and CEO of the Santa Fe Group, and she's author and co-author of several books, including Reboot Your Life and The Retirement Boom. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, and I appreciate you having me on the program.
It's great to have you. So we're talking about these two books. One, Reboot Your Life, is about taking a break during one's career. The other is about the way retirement looks today. And in a lot of ways, these books are related. They both reflect a number of big changes in American work life and society that have been going on really since our parents' and grandparents' time. And one of those changes has to do with how much time Americans spend working versus relaxing with their families. What does this look like now, and how has it changed?
So the theme of both books came from our own experience of taking sabbaticals. My co-authors and myself are all professionals. We've worked in the corporate life. We worked in national security. But we all had taken time off, and especially in making big changes or transitions in our life. And that's what gave us the impetus to start talking to people about the experience of work and work-life balance today. And as you know, in the United States, many people do not take vacation days. They leave them. Many people are not used to the idea of sabbaticals or a gap year. They think, you know, you're lazy or you're not being professional, or it might harm your career. Our research found out that's not true at all, but that's what we think about. I think there are two changes going on with regard to work-life balance, and it's more generational. The Gen Xers, which are, say, 35 to 50, were the first in the workforce to say, I've got to have more balance in my life. And they're the ones that started to either step out for a while they were having children, or to at least take positions that were less stressful. The millennials are taking gap years. The millennials believe that they're going to have many, many careers. So for them, the idea of working for a while, taking off for a year, working again, is something that I think is part of their DNA. And we are going to see more concentration on having personal time to be with family and friends and to follow passions that we might have.
It's funny when you talk about the Gen Xers saying, you know, we're going to really try to restore work-family balance. When you think about the generation that's older than that, I mean, those folks did not have to deal with 24/7 email and cell phone and the expectation of total accessibility all the time. And so there was kind of work-life balance built in a way that isn't now, particularly for people who are consultants of one kind or another. I mean, I've met people who have clients who expect them to answer texts at midnight.
Absolutely. And that's a good observation, because the boomers, and I'm of that generation, we, for a while, certainly when we first went into the workforce, you had pretty standard 40 or 50 hour work weeks. You did not have the technology to be to have to communicate at home. This is even before personal computers. So there was sort of a way that you always knew on the weekends and at nights, unless it was budget period or some big campaign that you had, that you really had free time. But the Gen Xers were the first to have the internet access, have PCs, have as you move into the mobile environment. So they're never away from work. And I see that with my stepchildren and a lot of young people that I mentor that are Gen X or millennials. They're never off. They're always thinking. And the Gen Xers and the millennials are facing a much more difficult work environment than the boomers did. The Gen Xers, there's only 40 million of them. And the boomers, as the retirement boom, the retirement book that we just finished and came out, talks about the boomers reinventing themselves and not retiring. And part of that is because they can't afford to, lost money during the financial crisis, or are going to live longer, and you've got to fund retirement till 100 or 105. So they're not leaving their positions, and the Gen Xers aren't moving up like in the past they did. And then you have these young millennials, 80 million of them, coming into the workforce who say, I want to be vice president tomorrow, or I want to run this business. And part of that's because the millennials have lived through very uneasy times. They've seen their parents or others lose their jobs during the financial crisis. So they don't really trust any institution, and they think about having to be their own contract workers. And so it's actually quite difficult, I think, for the Gen X in a millennial environment. And that's part of what drives them to say family and friends are very important. I've got to figure out ways to spend time with them and then to manage this work life.
And that mistrust of institutions is not random. I mean, institutions have become less trustworthy. I mean, even the institutions that my parents worked for, namely colleges and universities, are now hiring adjunct professors who are on food stamps with PhDs. And that's sort of the trend in every sector of society. I mean, the idea that there is even a coherent middle class is, it's no longer something to be trusted. And so, you know, we cannot really trust those institutions.
Absolutely right. You know, I could argue there's some good reasons. An institution might tell you because of international competitiveness and globalization of markets, so that you're now competing with things that may be made in Thailand or Vietnam or China that are less expensive, and therefore it has an impact on businesses here in the United States. But there are other trends, the trends against unions, and the unions gave us a middle-class life. I mean, if anything helped certainly the United States grow and to have a large middle class, that was part of it. Part of it is technology has taken away many of those middle class positions. And then you have, as you're talking about, you have many organizations will only hire part-time or temporary, or they've reduced the number of employees that they have, and they may outsource functions to other organizations, many of which are abroad. So it's all impacted the collapsing the middle class.
Not to mention excessive CEO salaries and bonuses.
Oh, yes. I mean, that's another thing that wasn't there before. Again, when the boomers entered the workforce, there was a more reasonable relationship. Always your senior executives were paid more. But I blame the hedge funds and the private equity funds, which have created this excessive CEO pay and perks that go along with it. And then you've got that. And then you have the extraordinary entrepreneurs, and this is a technology-driven entrepreneurs. We have many people in their 20s and 30s who are billionaires. And you look at some of those and they become a role model, but it's not a reality for most people. So you have this excessive incomes, you have the decreasing middle class, and then you have, as we've said, a workforce and people who are ready to retire but can't really retire. So again, the retirement boom and the Reboot Your Life books are both about passions that we as authors had about helping people to step back, give themselves what we call the gift of time to think about the next chapter of their life. Because otherwise, you're working so hard that you don't really have that ability to be reflective. And there's all kinds of science around creativity and innovation and time off or ability to think about other things than what your regular work environment is. Actually, in the Fortune Best Places to Work, 21 of them now are offering sabbaticals. And part of that is because they're beginning to see, if you want to attract and retain talent, that you need to offer this better options for work-life balance.
So all of this leads us to the topic at hand, namely sabbaticals. And I never looked at the obvious thing that was in front of me, which is that the etymology of sabbatical and Sabbath are the same.
That's right. You know, the 7 years, and then you let the land lie fallow because that's what rejuvenates it. 7 years in, and then being able to take time off and think about the next things you want to do. In most academic environments, it's oftentimes 7 years. Intel, which has one of the best known and longest running corporate sabbatical programs, offers their sabbaticals every 7 years. And we interviewed people from that. And it's so funny. Many of the people we interviewed said they were about ready to leave Intel. They were frustrated. They just wanted out. They took the sabbatical, which Intel gives for 2 months, and then you can add on your vacation days. And every one of them came back to Intel because getting away from it made them realize what a great company it was and what a great company it was to give them this opportunity to take a break and to refresh and renew. I will say of the 500 people we interviewed for the reboot book, half went back to their companies or organizations, half went on to new career or new opportunities, and everyone was successful. I mean, it was not, people fear that, oh, if I do this, I'm going to lose my job or I won't be relevant. Every one of them either was promoted or was happier. We did not find one bad story in the people we talked to.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking about this with somebody before our interview and who was saying to me, well, did she just select the people who did well after the sabbaticals? What about the people who fell through the cracks? But that doesn't happen.
We didn't find them. And the way that we selected, we did emails. We asked friends to introduce us to people. We went into companies that had offered sabbaticals to try to talk to people. And granted, it wasn't a statistically significant sample, but I think 500 people and no bad stories. I literally, the one story that was a turnaround, it was someone who wanted to have a bed and breakfast and they opened right when the financial crisis started. And so that did not work out for them, but they had done so well in their own companies. They went back for a while to their own companies and they're just saving up money and they're going to do it again in the future, follow that passion in the future. It was the research. It was, not only did we do research, but we have these retreats that I mentioned 4 times a year. We hold retreats only for 8 to 10 people in our homes. And I've done them for the last 6 years here in Santa Fe. And really interesting people, and people self-select to come. And for a weekend, we feed them gourmet food and we spend time doing exercises and helping them create a support group themselves. And these are all people that are in transition, whether it's career transition or whatever. But what came out of that is a lot of 50 and 60 year olds who said, I don't want to retire. I'm not ready to retire. I feel young. I want to stay in the mix. I want to stay relevant. Or I need to keep working because, you know, I don't have home equity or whatever happened. And that's what led to the retirement boom book, was seeing that people also needed to take time off to think about what they wanted to do in what we call this next chapter of retirement.
Well, one kind of sabbatical that you mentioned, the sabbatical book, is the pre-retirement sabbatical. Mm-hmm. What is that?
It's let's say if you're in your 50s or maybe early 60s and you may have a retirement age. Some companies have forced retirement at 65 or you age out or whatever it might be. Is maybe 5 years before then, start to take some time off, maybe a month, maybe 2 months, where you might explore places that you'd want to live because you may want to downsize and go to another community. Look at other career options that you have that might follow a passion. We found people that did internships, for instance, in a bakery. One of our best stories is a litigator, very well-known litigator in LA who loved to bake and was trying to figure out what he wanted to do next. And he had his mother's recipes for brownies and for macaroons. And he now supplies a number of great restaurants in LA. So he has his own time. He does a little legal work. He does the baking and he does concierge work. And he actually doesn't need the money. He's doing it just because it makes him feel, you know, relevant and fulfilled and following passions.
Well, one of the things about retirement that's so interesting is that a lot of people have a great deal of energy. I remember speaking to my grandmother when she was 77 and she was a physician. And she'd had a big and difficult life transition when she was 57. She lost her husband, and at that point, she thought about opening her own practice. And she thought, you know, I'm 57, it's probably too late to open my own practice. And at 77, she said, you know, I should have done it. I would have been doing it for 20 years. And she was still in absolutely stellar health and completely sound of mind, which she was until the age of 98 when she died. And there's a lot of self-limitations of what we're capable of that we put on ourselves. And I think your book and a lot of what's going on today really challenges that those limitations.
Absolutely. It challenges the idea that at a certain age, you're no longer relevant, or you are not smart, or you don't remember. In fact, I would argue you have great wisdom. If you go back to some of our Native American and other Hispanic cultures, which you do revere people who are older as being, as having that wisdom. But we're living longer. We're in better health. If a woman today or a man hits 65 and still healthy, a woman should live at least till 85, a man till 83 in good health. And each year that they pass 65 in good health, they're likely to live to 100. So you're going to see the boomers, a lot of boomers live to 100, 105 with full facilities and able to work. Part of this retirement thing at 65 or 62 was really artificial. It was put on by corporations and other businesses that sort of wanted to refresh the workforce. So they'd say, all right, at 65, you're ready to go. And it's the boomers who are challenging that, as we have every generation. An example is now many corporations are retaining boomers who have intellectual capital, whether it's in engineering or payment systems or whatever, and keeping them on retainer to come back in and mentor the younger people. And I think one of the most fun trends that I'm seeing, and I help do this, I sit on a board called Analytics Pros based in Seattle, and my stepson works for them. That's how I got to know them. It's a great company, and they're a Google reseller, started by two millennials when they were 24. They're now 29, 30. And they came to one of our retreats and they said, you know, we have this great company. We've got good, you know, clients like ASICS and Microsoft, but we really don't know how to run a company. And we don't know about HR systems. And you could just see they're poised to grow, but couldn't because they didn't have a system. Meanwhile, we had another attendee at one of the reboot retreats who had just retired as COO of a division of Pitney Bowes, and she was 58. And she's saying, what am I going to do? You know, most corporations won't hire me at 58, but I still feel like I have more that I can do. Well, she's now the CEO of this millennial company, and she's part nice. Mother, part consultant, but she's the CEO to help actually mentor these two millennials about running a business. Already she shaped it up excellent. The employees are happy and we're getting it ready to get a major investment or to, you know, eventually go public. But I see many opportunities for boomers who have wisdom and business experience or life experience that would help these millennials who are in their careers but kind of don't have that wisdom to pair together. And the good news is the millennials will listen. They're open to advice from older people, where the Gen Xers were kind of, I want to do it on my own and I can do it that way, as were the boomers. The millennials are used to listening to their parents or asking their parents for advice. So asking boomers for advice is kind of working. So I think you're going to see more companies happen that way.
We're talking to Kathy Allen about her books, Reboot Your Life and The Retirement Boom. Another thing that I kept thinking about when you were talking, when I was reading these books, is, I mean, if you have people who are over 65 and who are still working and who are still excited about life, that keeps you healthy. And I know that one of the great fears that we're looking forward to as a country is the cost of healthcare for baby boomers. And if you've got a lot of baby boomers who are in their 60s and 70s and still working, they're probably going to stay healthier longer.
That's absolutely right. There's social impacts, even though the books don't necessarily go into this in detail. I've been writing about this. There's a social impact of boomers working longer, first of all, on Social Security, because they're contributing for a longer period of time to Social Security, and they're building up their wealth again, and also that is less of a drain on society. Secondly, in the medical part, there's, again, science and research of the connection with staying busy, socializing, keeping your mental facilities agile. So the longer people are working, whether it's for themselves or however they're working, that's going to keep them healthier or keep them, as my dad used to say, he did die with his boots on. He kind of, you know, you're working and then maybe maybe that's when you pass away. But in any case, I am finding that the boomers, when they're doing this, they're repositioning so they have a much better work-life balance. So they're more in control of the time that they have off so that they can travel or can have their grandkids come stay with them for a while. But retirement today is much more than golf and grandkids. It really is about staying relevant and giving back. There's, as you know, a whole chapter on leaving a legacy, and the boomers, that's very important to the boomers.
Well, it's not all about golf and grandkids, but at the same time, there are a lot of people who are ready to get done with their work, but want to still stay active. And whether that be sports or volunteer work or art or spiritual exploration or all kinds of things, there is, I mean, you wrote about something that I'd never heard of and that it's a little bit hard to contemplate, but it was adult playgrounds, like jungle gyms and stuff like that for adults. There's a lot going on outside of the workforce.
Well, first of all, that's why we're here in Santa Fe. I think this is the most fabulous city in all of the United States because of the cultural diversity we have. But everybody that moves here stays involved. The people that move here, they get onto nonprofit boards, they give financially, they give of themselves, they volunteer, or they start little businesses. I mean, there's all kinds of little entrepreneurial things that are going on in Santa Fe by boomers who have said, you know, I don't want to just sit around and, as I said, play golf and read. I might still play golf, but I also want to be contributing. And we have a number of great institutes here, from the Santa Fe Institute to our academic institutes, great board, nonprofit boards that keep people involved. And that's what makes Santa Fe so interesting. Yeah, I used to say it was about the culture and the beauty, which it is. But you go to a dinner party or you go to an event in Santa Fe and it's like peeling back an onion and you find somebody who's won an Emmy, but they don't brag about it here. Nobody brags about their money or their you know, I was a famous XYZ, but you just find so many interesting people and they all want to give back. They want to make a difference. And that's what makes this such a wonderful place. And that is happening in other areas of the country.
One thing that I thought was interesting was that all of your co-authors, you and the three other people who wrote these books, are women. Now, are women more likely, for example, to take sabbaticals, especially those kinds of sabbaticals that are not funded by institutions? I mean, we haven't even really talked about that yet. There are people who, for whatever reason, decide and they just ask for leave from work, or they quit a job before they've gone on to a new job, or and self-fund that in one way or another. But is that something that women are more likely to do?
Well, that's a good question. In the people we interviewed, again, we tried to make it equal gender. So we interviewed half women, half men. I think that women may take different kinds of sabbaticals. They may have taken time off to either not only have a child, but stay with the child for a year. Or they might be open, they might be a caregiving sabbatical where they've taken time off because a family member is ill and they're the ones that end up doing that. They, I think, are more open to work-life balance. They understand the importance of family and friends. And I think in some ways understand that the tie between taking time off to refresh and renew and be more creative. Where men, if they tend to be more defined by their work, women tend to be defined by multiple roles. Men, and this is changing for the Gen Xers and millennials, but boomer men tend to be more defined by their work and are more, I think they're the ones that express more fear about taking time off because I might not be relevant or I might lose my job or I have to be there every day. Oftentimes they're the ones that benefit the most from taking time off because they realize that they can still be successful and have time for their family. And we had a number of people. One I remember in particular was with a PR crisis management firm in Seattle. And crisis management firms, I mean, those are crazy jobs because you get called in the middle of the night because, I don't know, there's a major fire or a data breach. But he said he realized after taking the sabbatical off, not only was he valued more at work and promoted because he came back with fresh ideas and new ideas, but he kept inviolate some of the things that he did on sabbatical, like being home, you know, at 6 o'clock for dinner 3 days a week. You know, he couldn't do it all the time, but he really worked to keep some of the things that he did during his time off. And he's very happy about that. And his family obviously is very happy about that because it made him better balance. And that's why, you know, if you look at Fortune, if the Fortune 21, these are large corporations, they're doing sabbaticals. I think they are getting it, that they're sending a message that it is okay to take some time to refresh.
There's also a kind of bigger picture, just the way there is with healthcare costs. There's a real big picture of how much productivity can you really expect from one human being? And we have this growth economy, for better or for worse, and I think a lot of people are beginning to realize that there are limits to infinite growth in so many different ways, but you certainly cannot get more productivity every year for 50 years out of one human being.
That's right.
And so if you can't get that, then you're going to have to rethink the whole thing. And Europe, in many ways, is way ahead of us in realizing that a real, genuine 40-hour work week and long vacations actually make them more productive.
You're absolutely right. And it kind of goes back to your first point, which is because of technology, you're never really off. And that takes a great toll on productivity. So now you're really looking at, are you productive between a 40 or 50 hour work week? Now it's all the time. And people are worn out. You cannot keep doing this without wearing out. And it's why you need the time to refresh and renew. And if you can't do that on a weekend, you can't do that at night because you're always still looking at your iPhone or your smartphone, you're going to burn out. So many of the people that we had on taking sabbaticals, they actually were burned out. I mean, especially people that were working for law firms or consulting firms, or where they're, you know, the expectation of your employer is that you're always on too. So it is a societal issue, and it's one where I think as the science catches up to say, actually, there are productivity benefits if you allow people to have downtime, then you're going to find business catching up with that. Again, I go back to the millennials. The millennials are going to, there are 80 million of them. They are going to change the workforce. They're going to change the way that we train. They're going to change the way that people look at how long they stay in a company. And I think they're going to change this work-life balance also.
We're talking to Kathy Allen about her books, The Retirement Boom and Reboot Your Life. Let's talk for a moment about burnout. One of the things about taking a sabbatical, and we can talk and should talk about how long a sabbatical has to be in order to be productive. I mean, you can't do this in a week or even 4 weeks, but one of the things that you have to do is really think about the time that you have, what you're going to do with it. And a lot of people, the first thing they do, especially if they're burned out, is just rest. Resting can mean just sleeping and sleeping and sleeping and just eating and sleeping some more, that kind of thing. And probably many of us have been in that position and done that. But then there are the activities that you fill your time with. And I think it's, you know, it's a little scary for people, especially people who have been in this sort of workaholic mode, to have this unscheduled time off, because that can lead to, on the one hand, a sense of freedom, and on the other hand, sort of morose brooding about the things that you're trying to get away from.
Right. Exactly. Well, let me address first lengths of time and then come back, because there actually are phases we found in our research of sabbaticals. There's no ideal time, although we found, I personally took an 11-month sabbatical, I took a 6-month sabbatical, I took a 1-month sabbatical. I think in an ideal world, if you could at least take 3 months, 2 to 3 months, it helps you get away, detach, rest, refresh, and get back. if you take a year sabbatical, it might be because you're changing jobs and you're really looking to maybe take some courses or travel or learn a new career or internship, something like that. But if you can find a way to take 2 or 3 months off, it's ideal. Even in a month, we talk about many sabbaticals, and I'll come back to that in a minute when I talk about phases. There are ways, even in a week or 2 weeks or a month, that you can do things that will help you, make you healthier and refresh. It's not as good as taking the 2 to 3 months because you're still kind of half in, half out. What we found is phases of a sabbatical is just as you said, the first phase is many people just sleep. They catch up with their checkbooks. They clean out closets. They, you know, do all those things, go to doctor's appointments, things that they really have not had time to do. Oftentimes people get sick, will have a cold or flu or something like that because their adrenaline and their immune system has been so used to run that when you stop, you actually can get ill.
It's kind of like getting sick after your final exams in college.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this happens in retirement too. Think when we're talking about sabbaticals or even the first phase of your retirement or next chapter, this oftentimes will happen. And it's one of the things science is looking at. You know, a lot of men have heart attacks or have severe heart problems when they retire abruptly. And part of that is, again, back to these immune systems and not having a function or a relevance going forward. So this first phase is really just catching up and getting yourself back to normal. The second phase we found, and this is whether the sabbatical is a month, 3 months, or a year, people went through this just at different time periods, was exploration, where now you're ready to travel, you're ready to reconnect with your friends and family, have lunch with them, do things that you're just out there exploring. And then the third phase is where you really start to think about learning new things. It's where you might take a course, or still it might be extended travel, but your mind is thinking about things other than work. And then the fourth phase, reentry, is when you start to think about, all right, now I need to pull my resume together or my bio together. I need to start if in fact you're not going back to your current employer, is to think about what I want to do next and make those contacts. And we encourage people, even if they've been let go from a firm because of a downsizing or something, we encourage them not to start looking for a job right away because they're not in the right mindset and they're not going to come off the right way. Their fear and their frustration and tiredness, everybody needs that downtime before they start looking for whatever that new career or new position is going to be.
Tell us about your own sabbaticals.
The first one I took was an 11-month one. I had been a professor at a university, and I was ready, and my husband at the time was ready to leave our positions. And so even though I had an opportunity to go back to the university, I had told them I pretty much would not be coming back. I wanted to go to Asia. We wanted to travel in Asia, and this was in 1985, and wanted to really understand what was going on in Japan and the growth in Asia. And my husband at the time had worked up on the Hill, so knew international trade issues. I had been a professor and taught marketing international business. So we traveled for 11 months. The USIA paid for small portions of that where we would go lecture. The embassy or a newspaper would host us in that city. And I had one suit that I wore and my high heels. Otherwise, we had Kelty backpacks that turned into suitcases, and we were on every mode of travel from trains to elephants to buses, and learned enormous amount. I had been interested in Japanese management and marketing practices, so we learned about that, learned about how Asia was growing, we were in 85 in China, which was really early to be there. So you could see what was going to happen. It was the best thing I ever did. Before I left, because I'm security conscious, I had been doing consulting for CBS and for Dun & Bradstreet and some other companies. My dissertation had been on the divestiture of AT&T and the impact that was going to have on information services and kind of the emerging information services of video techs. This is pre-internet. And so I'd written all my consulting clients and said I was going to be gone for 11 months on sabbatical. And when I came back, I would be looking for a position, and I would write them again. So I did, and unbeknownst to me, Dun & Bradstreet, who I'd done some consulting for, actually held a position for me in strategic planning in a new division of electronic Yellow Pages. And they did it because they thought if I had the guts at age 39 to take time off mid-career to go do a sabbatical, that I was the kind of entrepreneurial person that they wanted. So that's what happened. We came back and I went to work for Dun & Bradstreet. And so that was a excellent experience because I could pull in what I had learned for the year, but I also still had stayed relevant in what was happening in the information services area. And again, this is all pre-internet. The second sabbatical I took was when I was divorced and was getting ready to get married with another man, and he died right before our marriage, our wedding, of brain cancer. Diagnosed to death was 3 months. Very sad time. And at that time, I was CEO of a financial services consortium in Washington, D.C., the 100 largest banks. And I just needed time off. And so I took a month off to go to Italy. I totally detached from technology. I empowered my workforce to do everything. And I said, only call me if, you know, if there's really a disaster. And that was a wonderful experience because, first of all, by empowering my employees, they were able to do much more than I had even thought they could. It changed the way that I managed them. I then spent most of my time on strategic issues, no more of the day-to-day work. And it gave me this feeling, again, I was able to mourn. I was able to have a good time with friends who joined me on this trip. And I was able to come back and think about what I really wanted to do next. Then my third sabbatical was when I was leaving BITS, this financial services consortium in Washington. And I decided before I came back to my own company, the Santa Fe Group, which was still going, but I had a COO, that I would take 6 months off. And I would work in a presidential campaign. I would write a book, the reboot book. I would renovate my house. And I was dating my now husband at this time. This is where we write about the lack of communications. My husband, who lives in Cape Cod, in his mind, I was going to come up there and cook him dinners and sit on the beach and write a book. I had neglected to tell him, no, I was going to be in Santa Fe renovating the house and working in Richardson's campaign and writing a book and doing other things. And so we laughed about that. And it became a big part of the book of how you have to really communicate what you want to do. But again, that experience told me, A, I didn't want to go back to Washington and work in politics, and that I did get my house renovated, and I did like writing books. So I've been writing, my main career with the Santa Fe Group is in cybersecurity and risk management and emerging technologies, and that's where I spend time consulting. But on planes, when I write these books, like The Artist's Way at Work, which was one of the first books I wrote, and then the reboot book, and then the retirement boom.
And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, it's never too late to decide to become a writer.
Exactly.
If you're not financially supported by your institution and you want to take a break, I mean, the way we've been talking, it does seem to be geared toward kind of upper middle and upper class people. But there are ways that people who are not of financial means can also managed to take a break in one way or another. And one of the things that was sort of exciting in your book is you talk about people doing serious budget travel when they go places. How do people make it work?
So again, many of the people we interviewed for both books, we interviewed 500 for the reboot book and 300 for the retirement boom book. Many people were not upper middle class, or they were middle class or starting out. And several things you can do. One, you can save up, you know, like any Christmas gifts, or you can ask your family, instead of giving me sweaters, contribute to my sabbatical fund. Taking a windfall, sometimes an income tax return or something like that. Sometimes you can borrow. We don't recommend this unless it's the only resort, but you borrow from your retirement funds, but you pay it back. You write yourself a note and you literally make sure you pay it back. Sometimes you can get your corporation or your organization, even if they won't pay for the sabbatical, they'll keep your job and they will continue to fund your health care, which is important to have health care insurance. Sometimes you can work. Like when I did the sabbatical, the USIA paid for part of the expenses of the travel and a per diem of $200 a day. Well, there was something that helped us to do that. But you can minimize your expenses. And one of the most important ways you can do that, especially for your listeners here in Santa Fe, everybody wants to come to Santa Fe. You can rent your house or trade out your house so that, and I've done this several times in Ireland and in the Dordogne in France, in San Miguel de Allende, where I trade with somebody else and they come stay in my house and I stay in their house. So you're not having to pay the expense of a housing. You can cook, so it's a way to keep things more reasonable, and it gives you a way to be in a foreign country or just be not in your home environment. So there are ways to save up for it or to borrow to do it, and then sometimes you can work. There are some things like being a travel companion or possibly writing a blog, or maybe if you have a special skill that you can work a little as you're on sabbatical. Although we don't highly recommend that because we want you to be free when you're taking your time off.
One of the points that you just alluded to is not only how important it is to communicate with those people around you, especially your maybe spouse, children, things like that, about what you're doing, but also when you are suddenly, whether due to an extended sabbatical or retirement, suddenly in the house under the same roof with this person who you ostensibly love and get along with and are compatible with and all of that, it's a really big change.
Absolutely. We have a couple of quotes on that. I married you for life, not for lunch. And or whose kitchen is this anyway? And it's a big change that people don't think about, because usually one or both are working outside the house. And when you are both in your next chapter or retirement phase, you know, you may only have one office, and to share an office is difficult. Or your spouse may choose to want to do more cooking or be involved. And so there's a real, we call it renegotiating life at home in the chapter. And it's, I think, one of the most important chapters, because people don't think about that. Most retirement books, and this is the reason we wrote The Retirement Boom, most retirement books are about financial planning or having enough finances. It might be a little bit about downsizing your house, but it's not about the psychological and lifestyle issues. And we wanted this book to be a guidepost to help people think through some of those lifestyle things, from where you want to live, who you want to be around, you know, in terms of retirement, how you renegotiate what you are at home, and how you still can have an independent life and be with your spouse or partner or whatever it might be. And then two of my favorite chapters are what we wrote about leaving a legacy and simplifying your life, both things that people don't consciously think about. And certainly most of your investment advisors don't talk to you about that.
And it's never too early to think about both of those things. I mean, if you're, and one of the things in the sabbatical book, I mean, you might be taking a sabbatical in your 20s or 30s. You might be taking it in your 40s or 50s. You might be taking it pre-retirement. And in any of those times, it's a good time to think about clutter, of which many of us have way too much. And it's also a really good time to think about values, because many of us do not have necessarily the values of the families that we grew up in. Mm-hmm. And many of us don't embrace exactly mainstream American values. And to figure out what values are really yours in your heart and your soul, and then to live out of that, is something you don't really want to be thinking about at 60. You want to be thinking about that at 18 or 25 or 35.
That's right. And it's why the book, we had the hardest time in thinking about the title for The Retirement Boom, because first of all, the boomers don't like the R word. We think about it in reinvent, not retire. But what we see in there is relevant if you're in your 30s, 40s, or 50s. I mean, you should be thinking about what you want to do in every decade or every chapter of your life. And the values are the most important thing. I mean, that you've picked up the exact right thing. we might take some from our families, we might take some from society, but we really have to understand our own values. And we have an exercise that kind of gets at that in the book. We also have a value statement, which we found a number of people writing, where you might say, what are the 10 most important values that you hold? And find a way to communicate that and live it with your family or with your colleagues, and thinking about that legacy. And I will say the boomers are really thinking about that now. We did when we were in the 60s and we were sort of revolutionary. And I think now we're coming back around as people are hitting their 60s. And so thinking about, how do I want to be known? What do I want to leave behind, whether it's in my community or with my family? And understanding those values. And then that helps you think about philanthropy. Where do I want to spend my time volunteering or giving back? Or what do I need to impart to my children or my grandchildren? And there's an uneasy issue here going on, and it has to do with, you know, some of the political rhetoric and debates. The millennials get, I think, falsely tarred with the idea that they're the entitlement generation. They expect everything to be given to them, that they've been, you know, everybody wins at the soccer game, so they don't understand failure, things like that. I don't think that's really true. I think that's unfair. But at the same time, I think that they need more guidance about the value systems. And this is where having some wisdom from their, may not be parents, but maybe an older mentor, to think about what those values are and then how you live those values. And one of the things I do think is millennials will look at the values of a corporation, corporate sustainability, how do they treat their employees? So companies in the future, organizations in the future, are going to have to mesh their values and their missions to attract the best and brightest of the millennials.
Yeah, it's interesting because there are so many ways that our institutions and really our nation has failed us. I mean, when you look at the kind of self-image that post-World War II America had of itself, and it's still sort of trying to pretend that it is that, but the incredible inequality and racism and uncaring and dysfunctional medical systems and all of this stuff that are, I mean, they're not that hard to repair. They can be done. The will hasn't been there because the people in control don't really value those things. And so in a way, I think we all are kind of tasked with being rebels of one kind or another if we are to live in an ethical way.
Well, you bring up a great point. I mentioned to you that I had an interview earlier about what happened on the campus at the University of Missouri, and I'm chairing their we're doing a $1.4 billion campaign, and I'm one of the co-chairs. And part of the reason we're even doing campaigns are because it's a land-grant college, and the legislature used to fund up to 50-60%, and it's gone down in the last 6 or 7 years to 10%. So we're trying to make up the difference. And as you know, there were headlines about two racial incidents that happened on the campus, and actually the swastikas too. It's a very complex story, and I'm not going to go into it here, but I will say a part of the problem is the rhetoric that is out there, the political rhetoric that is going on today, the meanness of spirit that is going on in the political campaigns nationally, whether it's about immigration, about income equality, about women's rights. On one side, you have a really fearful, security conscious, afraid that they're losing control or value subgroup that are supporting many of these people who are speaking hate, basically. And there hasn't been enough pushback, I think, from the other side, which says we are a fabulous country. Equality, and going back to the idea of a middle class, is what has made us a great country. We can't lose that. We've got to really think about civil discourse, having ways to mitigate and to compromise on issues. If we don't have the appropriate leadership that show how to be civil to each other and to be kind and to compromise and to understand that's how you really, how life works, it gives people who are on the fringes the excuse to not do that. So I think we need a lot of healing in the United States. And I think that we can do it one person at a time, but we also have to be actively involved in public policy. One of my passions is to get more women, who I think understand this, into senior positions in organizations, onto corporate boards, and into public policy, so that the discourse will be more civil.
And back to some of the themes of your books, when you think about leaving a legacy, really thinking about what that means deeply, not only as a member of your family, but of your community, however big you decide that community is, whether it be, in the case of somebody like you, really working on a national level, or whether it be working in your neighborhood.
Right. And there's many ways that you can leave a legacy. That term oftentimes has referred to money. I think that's probably the least important legacy that you leave. There are many ways that by your acts, by being mentoring, by volunteering, by serving in public policy, serving as a volunteer or on a commission, there are so many ways that people can give back and leave a difference. And it can be as big as starting a business and leaving an endowment at a university. It can be as small as naming a brick and just the way that you treat your employees, and that teaches them how to treat other people as well. So I think thinking, going back to what you said, really understanding what your values are, not your family's, not the national, but what are your values, and then working out from that, how do I express that physically, and how do I do that financially, and how do I do that spiritually or mentally?
Kathy Allen is CEO and chairman of the Santa Fe Group. She's author and co-author of several books, including the ones we've been talking about, Reboot Your Life and The Retirement Boom. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I've enjoyed it and enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.